And then after you can.
Yes.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Michael Frieda from North Haven, Connecticut, and welcome to our State Animal Welfare Task Force meeting. I thank you for coming. I'd like to thank the members of the public who are here this afternoon for joining us, and I'd like to welcome our viewing audience on Connecticut TV, our viewers all across the state. Thank you for joining us and watching us this afternoon on this very important initiative that we have undertaken as part of Senate Bill 309. Before we get started, I'd like to ask our members to please introduce themselves, starting with Kimberly on my far left.
Good afternoon. My name is Kimberly McDonald. I'm a veterinarian at the Referral Hospital in North Haven.
Good afternoon. My name is Mark Bailey. I'm chairman of the City of New Haven Humane Commission.
I'm Paula Poplaski. I am the chair of the New Britain Animal Welfare League Commission.
I'm Diane Collette. I'm the NECOG Animal Control Officer and the co-chair for this task force.
Ray Connors, Connecticut Department of Agriculture, Supervisor of the State Animal Control Division.
Thank you very much. I'd like to start with our agenda this afternoon. Item number one, is there any public comment to our agenda? Seeing none, we'll move on to item number two. Item number two, ladies and gentlemen, and task force members, is old business. We received the minutes from our last meeting. It was approximately 14 pages. And what we did was we took the opportunity to try to distill those 14 pages into action points that would be bundled under the category of old business. I'd like to take this opportunity to pass this out. This is a summarization of the email I sent out during the week, and this represents the distilling of 14 pages into some action points. And I know that Mr. Bailey has some comment on this also in terms of some augmentation of these points. So that is a basis for our discussion. Now, for the public who's here, our goal is to develop cogent and salient action points, and in the end, to present opportunities and issues for the state legislature to vote on, the state legislative body to vote on, in terms of putting in more robust systems and procedures to enhance animal welfare across the state. So I'd like to start with item number 2A, a review and discussion of the minutes of the October 1st meeting. Are there any points, counterpoints, additions, subtractions, deletions to those minutes? Any questions? Okay. Seeing none, I'd like to entertain a motion to accept the minutes of the October 1st meeting. Can I have a motion?
So moved.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any other discussion regarding the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor? Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes. And that is item number 2B, motion to approve the minutes. 2C, a review of all of the motions made and passed at the October 1st meeting. So I would ask you to look at this summarization of that meeting, and we can go through these. And we certainly would like to hear if there's any other input on these 10 points. So number one was deciding whether we formally recommend to the state a change of designation for the classification of dog pounds within municipalities, changing that to animal shelters. That was a motion that was accepted and passed. Any comment on that?
Just one question for clarification. Are we commenting just on the content, or are we actually having the discussion of each of these items at this point and the reports and follow-ups that might go along with them?
I'd like to have a discussion on all the points, but I'm open for suggestions on how you'd like to do that today, if we go one by one, or I would suggest we go one by one.
Sure.
Any comments?
Okay, good. Okay? Thanks.
So, Mark, coming back to your point, item number one. Any discussion? We think, for the members of the general public, that designation is a much better designation. Many of us felt at the last meeting that the phrase dog pound is antiquated and archaic. So the question is, do we want to formally recommend the change of designation?
I guess I'll start the comments. I'm in favor of recommending a change, and for the reasons stated, I think there are associations with the term dog pound that don't represent the purpose of this task force and the hopes and objectives of this task force. With that said, for instance, in New Haven, the official name of the shelter, according to the Board of Aldermen, is the Robin I. Krugman New Haven Animal Shelter. So in New Haven, it's known as an animal shelter already and referred to as an animal shelter. So I think our recommendation, and maybe this is self-evident, our recommendation should have attached to it some statement of vision, ethical philosophy, something to explain, you know, what we think the term of animal shelter represents and why we're making that change, so that even for a place like New Haven that already uses animal shelter, we're still bringing across a certain message about humane welfare.
Any other comments? Raymond.
When I brought this up last month in our last meeting, it was just so that we could make that, recommend that statutory change in the language, because currently all our regulations and laws that deal with municipal shelters says dog pound on it. So the recommendation would be to make that statutory change in the wording.
Any other feedback?
Does changing the name necessarily change the philosophy, I guess, is where I'm stuck. What makes a shelter, and a pound, a pound? Is there anything
from my seat, I look at it from a statutory language aspect.
And only a language.
And
aspect.
Only a language as okay. a regulatory agency that I represent.
Okay.
And I guess, because again, I'm in favor of the recommendation. I'm just curious how we're going to answer the question why. You know, why are we changing that language? What are responses to that? Is it simply to use more updated language? Is it because there is statutory language, and then there is also just the common language, the associations that are made with one term or another. So I'm wondering how my fellow commissioners feel about why we're changing the language.
I think it's a very interesting question that's posed here. On one hand, we're proposing the statutory change, the language to be changed. So I would answer the question by saying that there's a greater ability for us to change the philosophy, as Paula mentioned, by having the name changed. And perhaps the first step is to change the name statutorily, and then as this commission moves forward, we develop procedures that help recommend changing the philosophy. That may be the best short-term approach. Any comment?
Sure. I think that's a fantastic way to approach it, and I wonder if even the first step could simply be to say that it's not just about dogs, that we're referring to them as dog pounds, but animal shelters is a more inclusive term. To represent that companion animals are really being housed in these facilities, not dogs. So there's just a plain semantical issue for clarification. I wonder if that's an acceptable first step as well.
Raymond.
Again, from a regulatory and looking at the way that the law is written, municipalities are only obligated to impound stray dogs, quarantine cats for bites, but there's nothing that allows them to house stray cats unless the town adopts an ordinance to do so. So there's a lot of changes that would have to be made to follow what you're saying. What you have to remember is what and I spoke about this at the last meeting, that the purpose of the dog pounds / animal shelters in the municipalities is not for long-term housing. It's short-term housing. It's to keep the animals safe and keep the public safe from animals roaming loose on the street.
Any other comment? Kimberly.
I would just like to say I think that shelter is a more appropriate term for today's standards. And rightly or wrongly, the public does prefer to go to a shelter versus a pound, either to get their dog or find a new one. I think it's moving in the right direction.
Any other feedback? All right, so what I'd like to do here is that this was a motion to decide on recommending this change, this legislative language change. So I'd like to procedurally ask for a motion to formally recommend a change, a legislative language change, a statutory change to the state to change the designation from dog pound to animal shelters. Can I have a motion on that?
So moved.
We have a motion. Is there a second? Second by Paula. Any other discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes. So this for planning and development, Mr. Peter Mishevsky is here today. He's going to be handling the administrative aspect of this task force. He has a great deal of experience in working with task forces, and we're very happy to have him. That is the official recommendation of this task force to make that statutory change. Thank you. Let's move to item number 2 on the summarization. As this relates to the agenda, we're actually still on section 2, and we are in section 2B and 2C right now, and probably stretching into 2D. That's where these action points, which are a summarization of the minutes, fall within this agenda. Let's look at item number 2, and for the general public, let me read item number 2. Reviewing the current list of animal shelters or shelters across the state, This was an action point from the October meeting. Raymond Connors was very gracious in supplying us a list of the shelters and determined the standards of review within Connecticut's municipal animal shelters to improve adoption practices and awareness. Discussion.
In reviewing the current list, there are a few things that I would like to see on this list: the capacity of each shelter, the contact information, and whether it is run by the police department or by the city. Is it possible to get that? Maybe not right now.
Raymond?
It's not impossible, but it's not a record that our department keeps. In other words, this is not something that we would have on file. But it's something that I'm sure would be doable. And it would take some time, but it is doable.
I think it's a very good recommendation, because what we have before us, even though we know it's going to take some time, what we have before us is a list of all of the shelters across Connecticut. To add to that list, to make it more robust in terms of the capacity and some of the things that Paula mentioned, Raymond, even if it took a few months, I think it's an endeavor worth our while in terms of seeing. Even if it took 5 months, 6 months. But the question is, do we have the resources to really do it and compile the information?
That's always the tough thing, is finding the resources to do it. You're looking at the resource,
right?
And my schedule is very, very, very tight. So,
what we could do to develop this information is to have a subcommittee, and we can have two or three members of this task force be part of the subcommittee to help Raymond to work on this. And some of the solutions I would propose: perhaps a blast email out to all the ACOs across the state, asking them for some information, and then the task force subcommittee could be the ones acting as a repository for that information. Does that make sense?
Even that's a hurdle, because we don't have email addresses for all the animal control officers in the state.
Okay. Would it make sense then to have a subcommittee locate those email addresses as part of the research?
Why don't you just let me work on this, and I'll pull together as much information as I can for the next meeting, and then we'll take it from there, whatever obstacles I run into. I'd be happy to do that.
Okay.
I'd be happy to help Paula do that, too.
Okay. We'll work on it together. Yeah.
Okay. So for memorialization in the minutes, Paula and Diane will be working on developing this information. That'll include a database of emails and perhaps even reaching out and securing the information. Thank you. Any other comments, feedback on item number two? Mark?
Yeah, I think ultimately, in order for us to be able to determine the standards of review within Connecticut's municipal animal shelters to improve adoption practices and awareness, we have to have a better sense of what those practices are right now. So I'm envisioning as one possibility, as an extension of the work that can be done that we just discussed, is some sort of survey, again, so that we would find out just what those practices are in our shelters, information, basic statistical data that is necessary to understand this, including live release rate and euthanasia breakdown. Information, by the way, which these shelters already are recording for state requirements and municipal requirements, things like medical and temperament evaluation practices, what's in place, what's the euthanasia policy, is there a volunteer program, is there a foster program, do they work with rescues, what are their adoption statistics. These are all critical bits of information to, again, understand what those practices are, if we're going to suggest how they improve those practices. So it's a major project, but it's hard for me to envision how we're going to make such recommendations without understanding what's really going on in the various shelters.
Raymond or Diane, right? Any comments on that? Diane?
I have a question. Perhaps you could enlighten me. Is there a true standard for these dog pound shelters across the state for some of the points that Mark made? Is there testing of every dog's temperament before they're adopted? Is there any standard in any shelter? It's simply that animal control officer doing the best that they can do per shelter? Is that what's going on?
We don't have any standards as far as behavior testing applications. We have regulations that we need to follow for the actual facility.
Okay, so then, you know, if there's a wandering dog that's loose and you hold it for so many hours before it can be claimed or adopted out, and I understand that those regulations exist. However, I guess I'm looking at this as a more of the welfare or just the overall practice in each shelter, not necessarily the state regulations for must house for X amount of time, must quarantine, anything. Is there any regulation beyond those state recommendations?
No.
Raymond.
I mean, we have housing regulations, minimum standards that have to be met for housing. But it's up to each municipality as to adopt their own policy as far as their adoption protocols or their euthanasia policies. The state does not get involved in telling municipalities how to operate their facilities.
Thank you.
So we have shelter regulations. We have a policy that Raymond just mentioned. But we still have an open-ended component, as Mark just illustrated. So how do we, or can we, take what we have, use that as a foundation, and build off of that foundation to set some additional standards, knowing that the state doesn't regulate the local municipalities? At least, perhaps, this task force can come up with some recommendations for all of the animal shelters to use. So how do we bridge what we have into a very nice foundation and then build off of that for a review of standards? Any input on that? Mark.
At the risk of repeating myself, I think certainly this is an appropriate discussion for the task force on the humane treatment of animals in municipal and regional shelters. And my work and study of the shelters in my region of the state indicates that they're looking for this guidance. They would welcome this guidance. We're involved in this in New Haven quite intensively right now. So again, I think, though, it's formulating a better understanding of what those practices are, what is going on, having a better sense of what shelters are doing certain types of evaluation, which of them don't, which are using volunteer programs, which aren't. I would be happy, by the way, to take a first go at drafting a survey, a 1 or 2 page survey, to present at our next meeting for review, just to get more information about what's going on. And to end that by saying that, you know, one of the observations we made going into this task force is that the variety and diversity of practice among animal shelters in this state is quite extensive.
Raymond?
I think this is where public testimony will play a huge role, if we listen to public testimony, to find out what is going on out there statewide. I know that Mark works closely with the city of New Haven, but I'd like to see what's going on in other parts of the state, and not only other parts of the state, but other parts of the country. And it would be nice that if we do have public testimony, that perhaps some national groups would be willing to come in and testify as to what they've seen across the country as far as standards that were set and protocols set.
Very good. So, Mark, you will thank you for volunteering to do that. And that will be an issue for our discussion at the December meeting based on what you're able to come up with. Ray has recommended a great recommendation that at our next meeting we're going to include on the agenda a category of public testimony, and that we'll do that every commission meeting from here on in. So,
Mike, just in addition to that, I wonder if we could also either at this meeting or next meeting entertain how we can get some of that national feedback. As you know, I have something to report on that later, but in terms of perhaps having representatives from national shelters that have advanced in this particular way to bring them here to this meeting, just how we could facilitate that. I, for one, have some recommendations in mind, and I'm sure others might as well, okay, of who we could have.
Any other comment?
Right. I know we have one national organization actually right here in the audience today, Annie Hornish from the Humane Society of the United States, and I know that the ASPCA plays an active role in this building, and I'm sure that they would be happy to have a representative here.
Excellent. All right, so the action point from number two is that Mark Bailey is going to come up with a list of recommendations for us in terms of standards of review for us to propose to the state, which we will end up the state recommending those standards of review for municipal shelters.
Actually, just a small adjustment. Yes. What I'm offering to do is create a survey, for us, if that's right, to gather information so that we can eventually do exactly what you mentioned.
Thank you for the correction on that, and Peter will note that correction. Thank you. Any other discussion on point number two? So let's move to number three. Determine whether or not we recommend training standards to be adhered to at the shelter level for ACOs. Any comment?
Can I just Can I clarify that point? Forgive me for my ignorance. Are there standards that you have to, or training that you have to go through to become an animal control officer? Is there any in place currently?
Right now, we are required to do, new ACOs are required to do 80 hours of training. Present ACOs are required to do 6 hours. And the new ACOs are also required to do 5 hours of Connecticut law training with Ray.
So when you refer to training, are you talking about training with how to handle an animal incident? You refer to knowing and being familiar with the laws, but are you training with respect to how the shelter runs, your budget, paperwork, or animal behavior?
What we do is we have required, actually the statute spells it out exactly what the curriculum is supposed to be. And it shadows the National Animal Control Officers Association Training Academy. And it's everything from shelter operation to constitutional law to animal behavior to proper food and diet to animal first aid to, I mean, it just covers the full gamut. And it's a minimum of 80 hours that they have to do. And it's well past that, actually, their mandatory training. And the same goes for their annual training. It's a minimum of 6 hours, which I think is really too low. But so a lot of officers go way past that. I mean, 6 hours is nothing. And we're seeing numbers coming in, people doing 50, 60 hours a year in continuing education credits. So
I'd just like to make a just further comment with respect to my personal experience. I've been in New Haven and now in North Haven for a total of 10 years, really, actually, working at an emergency hospital where I've worked with a lot of animal control officers. However, I've also done a lot of additional work just around the state, and so I've unfortunately had to deal with lots of situations where animal control officers were in play and took a large part of the situation, and my personal experience is that probably 60% of them really could handle the dog well, and I didn't really feel safe with some people. In fact, I even witnessed a terrible incident with one dog, and I would say that 6 hours is too low and that there should always be a standard, and I'm kind of shocked that the one particular incident that I was sad to say privy to even happened, given the standards that are currently in place. So I think there really definitely should be, and they should definitely go through some sort of cross-check and not just under the direct ACO where they are in that municipality to make sure it is standard across the state and not just in that town where the town is better trained or just doing better because they have a better, more familiar, more competent current ACO.
Raymond?
I think that was actually the purpose of the law for the mandatory training was so that we would have standardization across the state. The law's only been in effect for 2 years, so it's going to take some time to weed out the bad ones, and I actually made this comment at the last meeting was, you know, when I spoke at the Animal Control Officers Conference back in September, I look out into the audience and there's so many new faces that we're actually seeing a whole new generation of animal control officers come into the state that are trained and are professionals, and it's just not somebody's brother-in-law that needed a job to be the dog catcher, so it's changing.
Mark?
One of the things that strikes me about this topic is that in addition to, if you will, kind of the official training sessions sponsored by the state, there's so much opportunity now for supplemental training and online training, which I think potentially this task force could play a role in at least recommending and bringing to the attention of the ACOs and the various shelters as we try to do in New Haven, the ASPCA, Maddie's Fund, for instance. I just watched a webinar last night on foster programs. The Center for Shelter Dogs are just among the few that have these essentially online training courses, again, through webinars. Maddie's Fund will even award a certificate of participation at the end of their webinar that, again, can be used to show that someone was part of that. It seems to me, echoing Kimberly's observations too, the assistant ACOs can especially be undertrained as well. And in a town like, in a city like New Haven, it's actually the assistant animal control officers who are going out and doing most of the work in the city and handling the dogs. And I think we in the Humane Commission, it's a matter of public record, have expressed our concern at the lack of training on being able to work with the dogs in those situations. So I wonder if we could in some way investigate, again, make recommendations through supplemental training, these other resources that can, Ray mentioned, you know, maybe it's not enough. This can help fill some of the gap a bit.
Would it help if we reviewed at the next meeting the actual standards that are in place and laws that Ray mentioned that have been in effect, Ray, I think you said, for 2 years, use that as a starting point to look at and then perhaps build off of that. Would that be a plausible action point on item number three for the next meeting? A review of the statute, Ray? And
statute's always open to
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that may be a good platform for the discussion. Any comment on that? Anybody disagree with that? All right, so the memorialization of this action point will be that at our next task force meeting, we will be reviewing the actual statute that's in place, and this task force will then review that and look to make recommendations to augment that, expand that, or maybe make it better. But we will need to review the actual laws that are in place first. Any other comment on item number three? All right, moving on to item number four. Item number four reads, and again, this is a distilling of the 14 pages of minutes, these action points. To determine whether it's timely or too premature at this point to reach out to the national organizations on animal welfare for funding, and if we decide that it is too premature, we may want to consider identifying a time frame. Comments, please.
I don't think we're ready to present this. We're still reviewing.
Any other comments?
Related to this point, I did a bit of preparation for this meeting and have, if it's appropriate to distribute two documents talking about really discussing sort of the expectations of grant funding organizations from whom animal shelters and their municipalities seek major and supplemental resources, if this is a good time to hand that out.
Sure, we'll pass it out.
So I prepared these documents simply for our review and consideration as we continue to consider this particular aspect of our work. These documents reflect discussions I had both with representatives of Maddie's Fund, benevolent donors, and also those shelters such as the Multnomah County Shelter in Oregon, the Sarasota County Shelter in Florida, and others that are currently receiving or have recently received national funding. One document is about what generally those expectations are. In other words, if an organization such as Maddie's Fund is going to in some way support the efforts of a shelter, these are the types of things they're looking for. And also, I think this is an opportunity to talk briefly about the Assimilar Accords and the role they play. Because most national funding organizations, Maddie's Fund in particular, are looking for an awareness of, an adherence to, a commitment to, in fact, the Assimilar Accords. So the second sheet just describes very basically, for those who aren't familiar with the Assimilar Accords, what these accords propose to do. These resulted from a gathering in 2004. And the accords propose a national standard for the humane treatment of animals in public shelters. And this is where the terms healthy and treatable were codified. So that when, for instance, I or my colleagues use healthy and treatable, we're not actually speaking in abstractions, or they're not my personal definition, but it's actually according to the definitions outlined in advance by the Assimilar Accords. All that, of course, is available on their website. And the idea is that for those shelters who are trying to increase their live release rate, those shelters who are looking to find ways to save healthy and treatable animals and to make sure they get adopted to the public, these are standards, guidelines, what have you, that will help them do that over time in a strategic way. Again, most organizations are looking for an awareness of, if not a full commitment to, the Assimilar Accords as the basic standard for grant funding.
Comment, feedback. So do we agree that maybe we were a little too premature? This is a very important component, long range, I believe, on this task force, but we have some comment and some opinion that it's a little bit too premature at this point. Any other opinions, please?
I think we need to wait on this.
Kimberly?
I agree. I think it's premature at this point. We need to have better defined objectives for them.
Mark, any other comment on the documents?
Yeah, I agree. I think this is our opportunity to study what those national standards and expectations are, and to continue to talk to those animal shelters and other public organizations that are receiving or have received funding to know how they fulfilled some of these criteria. So we have in front of us, at least today, a list of what the criteria are and the connections that can be made. And then I'd say a next step, again, is to discuss how these criteria get fulfilled, what kind of timelines are the expectations of the grant funding agency, some of which we'll actually get to in other reports I have prepared for today. But I think that's where we're at this point.
So to memorialize the point from item number four, we agree as a task force that it's a little bit too premature. However, we will have continued discussion, analysis, feedback, And down the road and down the line on this task force, we will have some action-oriented items regarding this. Mark, thank you for the documentation. Any other discussion on point number four? All right, let's move on to point number five. Review suggested language to improve existing legislation regarding standard practice of humane welfare for animals. Now, this was a motion accepted and passed in the last meeting. Feedback, comments. All right, so I'll give you a personal opinion how I see this. It almost ties into what we talked about a little bit earlier in terms of reviewing standards. So my suggestion for your consideration, the task force, is to take item number five and agree that we've already discussed most of this and what we're trying to accomplish by reviewing the state statute at the next meeting, looking at that as a foundation and a platform to build off of, and we could perhaps take number five and incorporate that into what we talked about earlier. Any comment on that?
I agree.
One quick comment is that for those of us who regularly pore over the state statutes and know how detailed and extensive they are, maybe some guidance in terms of which statutes to be focusing on, and as much as just saying these are the statutes that really are relevant, as opposed to those dog statutes, for instance, that really don't play into this. Just because it can be a little overwhelming to try to sift through all the state laws, many of us know.
Any other feedback, comments? Okay. Peter, do we have the action point then we talked about? This will be incorporated under our previous discussion regarding review of the statutes. Item number six, a review of other states' animal abuse registry policies and potential adopters' past history with animals. This was a topic of discussion that we had at our last meeting regarding what we think as a task force is a very critical area right now in this overall world of animal welfare. Any feedback, comments on this?
Where are we going to get this information from?
This was supposed to be from the legislative review process here. So now Deborah's not here. She was called away to another meeting. Damon, do you have any feedback at all?
Just one observation is, I know when officers or animal control officers are doing adoptions, they don't have access to the NCIC records or the collect system. It would be nice if there was a central area that they could call that would have access to the collect system, whether it's my department or within their own department, but to have animal control officers on board to have access, even if it's just state animal control, to have access to the collect system and have the collect training so that, say, Diane wants to adopt out an animal, she would call the Department of Agriculture and see if this person's name pops up on the National Crime Investigation System. And I think that would be a huge step, because we talked about this registry and the pitfalls that it may have, but I think this might actually be an answer to that.
Any questions for Ray on that?
Just a comment that when the ACO is a member of the police force, as is the case in New Haven, that person has access to police records. But, of course, for ACOs who aren't members of the police force, then that's a hurdle. And that's one that I'd love to see addressed and overcome.
Do most shelters have access to internet and computers?
Some are still in their infancy. I think a lot of them are still running Windows 3.1. So.
And Paul, I can answer that question on behalf of New Haven. New Haven finally does have internet access at its shelter, finally. We're in the year 2014, and the ACO is able to use it through his phone, and we are now trying to implement shelter management software programs, because everything at the shelter is done paper and carbon copies and by hand. So they're also not benefiting from the resources and that come with the online databases.
Let me try to frame an action point on this for the task force to consider on item number six. Two starting points, perhaps, are using the legislative research arm that's here at the LOB as a mechanism to do some research, what other states do. And I'll take the responsibility of talking to CCM, Connecticut Conference of Municipalities. We have access through them, through some extensive research that they can do for us. And perhaps the two repositories of information would allow us a good foundation to work from. Any comments on that?
That's a good start.
Yeah, I think that's terrific.
Good question on timeline. I'd like to say by the next meeting, but realistically it may be in the January meeting. So we'll set a timeline of our January task force meeting, and maybe Peter can help us with the legislative research aspect. I'll work with Connecticut Conference of Municipalities, and if we have information at our next meeting, we'll know that soon enough, but let's target the January meeting. So the memorialization of this action point is that we'll look at the legislative research arm here. I will take the responsibility of CCM, and we'll set an action target time frame of January for a review of what other states are doing. Any comment? Item number seven. A review of whether we move forward with an animal abuse registry and what state agency would manage it. Now, this was a motion that was passed and accepted, so I'd like to open this up for discussion. All right, so let me frame this up for some feedback and to work towards an action point. My recommendation for this group's consideration is we start with six, review what other states are doing, and once we determine that analysis, we build off of that with the determination for item number seven. Mark?
Ray, at the risk of asking you to repeat yourself from last month's meeting, excuse me, would you mind sharing with us again the new law that went into effect, the child abuse and animal abuse? Yeah, exactly, and how that works. Thank you.
Okay. Effective October 1st of this year, Public Act was implemented. It now requires animal control officers, whenever they suspect a case of animal abuse, that they have to report it to the Commissioner of Agriculture within 48 hours. That information is then compiled and turned over to the Department of Children and Families, who review that information and cross-reference it to see if they have any open or active cases dealing with the same parties that are involved in suspected animal abuse, and something that they could look into to protect children. By the same token, Department of Children and Families, if they suspect any type of animal abuse, they in turn notify the Commissioner of Agriculture. This past month, the law, prior to this law, the way the other law was written wasn't working. In a two-year period of time, we had maybe two cases reported to DCF. This past month alone, we submitted eight cases in 1 month to DCF, and in turn, DCF has submitted two cases to us in 1 month's time. So we're going to see a huge difference. And not only that, it's also giving us a view of what's going on in the state and the type of abuse that has been reported this past month is very upsetting as to the violence that is going on with animals statewide.
Any other comments? As far as starting with point number 6 and then building down at a future task force meeting, point number 7, does everyone agree or disagree with that?
Okay.
Mark?
Agreed. And also, if we could continue to hear statistics, as Ray just said, updates on how this law is having impact. I think it's incredibly important for us to know about as well.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. And actually, January 1st, I have to submit a report to the Standing Committee on Children on just how well the law is working. So, I have to give kudos to Representative Diana Urban for that law. She really made a huge difference, I think.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
Raymond, would you be able to share that report with us at a future meeting?
Yeah, it's a legislative report, so it'd be available, I'm sure. Yeah, that would be after January 1st.
After January 1st, okay. So our action point, Peter, and planning and development on item number 7 is that we're going to start with item number 6. We're going to build that database first. We'll build off of that to point number 7, but to Mark's point, we'll continue to have discussions and review the statistical information that Raymond would be able to supply us. Any other comments on item number 7? Okay, moving on to item number 8. Review any research done on other models regarding rescues and adoptions. This was a motion passed and accepted. Comments, please.
A few weeks ago, I met with the director of the Multnomah County Shelter in Oregon for this purpose, and I have one handout to distribute as part of that, and I'll give a brief report on our discussion. The Multnomah County Shelter serves as the public animal shelter for Portland and then the area outside of it, often with larger states geographically. They use county shelters as opposed to municipal shelters, but systematically the structure is really the same. It has the same goals and objectives in mind as we do with our municipal shelters. The Multnomah shelter also adheres to the similar accords for which we have the handout before. And what you see in the handout that I just gave, the statistics show in 2006, the Multnomah shelter basically committed to the principles of the similar accords, again, to work toward increasing the live release rate, increasing putting healthy and treatable animals into homes, and reducing the euthanasia rate. And then you can see in the chart from 2006 to 2013, actually, with dogs. In 2006, the live release rate of dogs was 70.8%, and now in 2013, it reached 92.7%, which is quite an increase. And in fact, right now in 2014, they're at over 93%. Cats, perhaps it's even a more dramatic statistic. In 2006, only 37.6% of stray cats were found homes, the rest were euthanized, and now in 2013, 82.7%, and again in 2014, that has gone up. So how did they do that? And by adhering to the similar accords, again, national funding and other forms of benevolent funding, if you will, played a major role because they had committed to this idea of essentially saving more lives, of a community standard that healthy and treatable animals that are homeless deserve homes. That gave them a lot of support from Maddie's Fund and other groups. They did it in their description. This is a data-driven program, so it's the use of data to drive forward, to implement new policies, to explore new opportunities. They were saying, really, you examine the euthanasia rate, you examine where euthanizing is going on in the shelter, and then seek opportunities to address those various issues, and over time can address them through the creation of foster programs, volunteer programs, other adoption practices, better evaluation, all the things that we're beginning to talk quite a bit about on this task force. Collaboration was also a key component in their live release rate reaching 93%. And by the way, I should mention that the goal is now as a national standard is around 90%. With the similar accords and with the grant funding agencies, if you've achieved 90%, that's considered to be really outstanding work in terms of a live release rate. Collaboration, so working with the local rescues, working with the humane societies, all those programs, building a community standard, and this is where the idea of no-kill communities really comes into play. It's important to recognize the term no-kill, which has been misunderstood by many for a long time, is seen in light of the assimilar accord. So no-kill is basically synonymous now in this setting with healthy and treatable. It's not suggesting, for instance, an animal that is terminally ill and suffering be sustained regardless. That's not really what no-kill means. So to build a no-kill community, the idea behind it is that the veterinary community, the rescue communities, the public shelter, the public itself, work together to pool resources and find ways to enable healthy and treatable animals to be rehomed, to be adopted, and to lead healthy lives. And they're incredibly successful at it. There's quite a bit of outreach to the public, and the public supports their efforts. The municipal government supports their efforts. It's systematic. They have yearly goals. And in fact, not only did they get quite a bit of funding to achieve what they have now, they even were rewarded $90,000 from Maddie's Fund simply to say, good job. So there's really quite a bit out there, and they're an example that many of our shelters can look to. The other thing that they mentioned there is that several cities now have articulated or committed to a no-kill goal. Again, I want to stress this means healthy and treatable animals. Los Angeles, Baltimore, Jacksonville, and Denver, for instance, are all cities that are committed as a community to having a no-kill environment. So those are it was a very productive discussion, very informative discussion. The folks at the Multnomah Shelter were incredibly happy to hear about this task force. They think this is a great idea and even wish they had one in Oregon, and are certainly willing to work with us and supply any other information we may want from them. Again, just as an example of a public shelter that has done incredible things and received quite a bit of funding to help them.
Mark, in conjunction with your report, I have an article on Columbus, Georgia, and I'd like to pass this out. And this is an example of another city that has reduced over a 3.5-year period euthanasia or kill rate from 79% to 19%. There's an 8-point program that Columbus, Georgia is utilizing right now. And I'd like to ask this task force to read that. The 8 points that you'll see on page 1 represent, in my mind, taking fragmentation and bringing fragmentation of resources into a cohesive unit to help reduce euthanasia or reduce the kill rates. So this is a very interesting article that ties into the chart that Mark just mentioned. And I have copies for anyone else who would like a copy of this.
And Mike, just glancing over those 8 points right now, I can see that the Multnomah Shelter in Portland uses all 8 points. So these are standards across the board. These are, and I know quite well, for instance, another shelter, Sarasota County Animal Services, another one that fits this description. They use all 8 points as well. And I'd say Brantford, Connecticut does too.
Any other comments? Any other opinions or feedback? Raymond.
Just one question to Mark. How do they address dangerous dogs?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Dangerous dogs, how do they address that? Is that included in their euthanasia rate?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's through the an evaluation process. So when a dog is when a dog is evaluated too dangerous to be released to the public, they go through a program of attempted rehabilitation. So they work with a behaviorist and try other things. In many cases, that works. In many cases, it's the environment that is causing a lot of this, the stress of the environment, the stress of the shelter environment, so foster homes and things like that. And then in those cases where, sadly, the dog's behavior just, you know, doesn't turn around and it's too dangerous, then the dog will be humanely euthanized.
Kimberly.
I'd just like to address your question as well. I've worked closely with the animal control officer in East Haven. Lovely gentleman. We work well together. We, not that long ago, had a bulldog who was, just by her breed's nature, a little bit more difficult to deal with, had been adopted out to two homes and reported back as just a questionable incident. That animal control officer and I worked together to get that dog into the proper placement where she is not a dangerous dog and has never had any of those repeat episodes again. So I think proper placement and follow-up care. And again, it was through resources of working together and another third party that we got this dog into a great home where she's happy and doing well and not euthanized.
Yeah, I actually know Officer Little quite well. He's actually a true old-school animal control officer. He's been around a long time and is very proactive in getting animals placed and running a very good animal control program for the city of East Haven. You know, when we're talking about the euthanasia, and maybe this is something that we as a task force could look into down the road, is requiring animal control officers on their monthly state animal control officer reports they submit to the Department of Agriculture that upon euthanasia that they list the reason for the euthanasia. I think that kind of data would help us immensely, is if we know the reasons. Is it because of space limitations? Is it because of behavioral limitations? Is it illnesses? Is it age related? I think that would kind of give us a direction really into what we need to concentrate on within the borders of the state of Connecticut.
Yeah, Hugh here. And I want to give credit to our new ACO, Officer Joseph Manganello in New Haven. The standard practice at the Humane Commission meetings every month was simply to report a euthanasia rate. But by virtue of our discussions about the similar accords, about the breakdowns, about these standards, he's now offering a breakdown and giving us the reasons why, and he did that on his own in response to our discussions. I would think at the state level that becoming just a common standard would be just really crucial to our understanding of, again, humane treatment.
Just one other sort of point of view, where I know we're talking really about dogs that are already in the shelter and making sure we're following up and going into the proper direction. But, you know, there's that source of where these dogs are coming from that are entering the shelter, you know, where the public is really not well educated about resources available to them, are cost prohibitive when they go to some animal clinics. We're talking about a population that sometimes really maybe perhaps can't afford the dog food for the dog, but they still do own them. A lot of these people really are unaware of any sort of resources at all, and it's not well, the information's not out there, and the importance of spaying and neutering and general wellness care is not out there. And I feel like there's the cycle of where that population is feeding the shelter. And I think targeting that population on some level to try to reduce dogs entering the shelter might be a goal at some point.
I agree. I mean, every day we read dogs are going to be put down because there's no room, there are too many dogs, they're full, they're at capacity. We have to figure out a way from the opposite end to keep them from getting in the shelter. There's got to be a way to, whether it's through education or understanding. I mean, you've seen it, Ray. I'm sure Sergeant Keller has seen it as well. These dogs are just dumped, and they've become the city and the municipality's responsibility.
Right.
Public outreach is huge. Humane education in schools is huge because it's the next generation that you have to educate to put a stop to this kind of thing. I know if you're talking about not affording foods. I know of quite a few municipal dog pounds in the state that actually have dog food banks that they donate food to people that are having a tough time. Even a lot of the towns and cities' food pantries now have look for donations of pet food to help people so that they're able to hold on to their pets and their families. I know that there's a lot of low-cost vaccination clinics that have been set up through CVMA statewide, especially rabies. I think that's helped immensely. There's a lot of veterinarians have taken it upon themselves to have low-cost clinics on weekends that has made a huge difference. So I have to agree that we should not be, that the municipal shelter should not be the resolve of their problem. It should be the place that they turn to for help for their problem without give them the tools that they need to so that they're able to keep that pet within their house. If the shelters just turn them away, they're just going to take the animal and dump it somewhere else. So if you're helpful, I think it would, you know, and as I'm talking here, my mind's going into another direction, actually. But it's also, you know, getting the animal control officers trained on how to deal with this, not the animal control officer that's just sitting at his desk and somebody comes in and says, I want to get rid of my dog. And they say, well, I can't take your dog, you know, go somewhere else. Well, they're going to end up with the dog one way or the other. So it's, you know, when somebody comes to their facility looking for that type of help, they may not come right out and ask for that kind of help, but you could sense that that's what they're looking for, and then maybe you could sit down with them and find out exactly what their problem is and how you could help them resolve it. So I think that maybe this can also go back to one of the other points we were talking about, reviewing the animal control officer's training and what's required of their training.
Any other comments? So let's try to take Paula's point and Ray's point and memorialize an action point as it relates to item number 8. So item number 8, just to review it again, is review any research done on other models regarding rescues and adoptions. So how about we consider approaching this from two sides? We will review research, and perhaps we can utilize ORL and maybe CCM again, to determine what's out there in other areas about programs that are designed to prevent animals from going into shelters, and then, that's Paula's suggestion, and then Raymond's suggestion is, on any euthanasia, memorialize to memorialize here, but also eventually make a recommendation to the state for the reasons why. Because the reasons will help us identify a solution also. Does that make sense? Peter, do you have that? Sarah? Thank you. So that'll be Mark, go right ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry, just to underscore how much I agree with that point and how important it is. If there are shelters that are euthanizing for space, there are other shelters and rescue organizations that can help alleviate that, but we have to know about that. And so being transparent about this, and I think the really wonderful thing about addressing this at the state level, again, is being able to get this information and then share resources. The national expectation is that one does not euthanize for space, for instance. So let's work together and make sure that we don't do that.
Kimberly?
Thank you. Yes, I would just like to say that perhaps if you're looking at sharing space, and hopefully we're not euthanizing for space, but we all know it happens, is that that's perhaps an area that could be supported by national funding so that we're not tapping into that municipality's budget, because I know that that's the fear of every animal control officer and the animals they have to care for at that point.
Another good point. Thank you. So as far as the research done on the front end, coming back to Paula's point, I'll handle CCM to see if they have any research on that. And maybe through Peter and Sarah, we can utilize ORL here to see if there's any data or research on that. And that'll be a good action point for us to approach this from both sides. All right. Moving on to item number 9. Review any research done regarding national organizations who utilize a volunteer program in shelters and what is comprised of in terms of job descriptions. And this was a motion passed and accepted. I have some thoughts on this, but I'd like to open it up to the group first.
I can deliver a small report on this as well. I took advantage of the opportunity of being at the Multnomah shelter to meet with their volunteer coordinator as well. Since we had discussed the idea of possibly a municipality or town appointing a volunteer coordinator to oversee that program on behalf of the municipality and town, the Multnomah County shelter has such a person in place. So I met with her, and it's a relatively new position. It used to be sort of a volunteer position, but now it is actually an employed, if you will, employed position by the county. And she runs a program that is thorough and large and thriving. They have actually several hundred volunteers there. They train, and I have their manuals with me, and they have various levels they achieve. So it's very systematic and very well developed. But basically, she was emphasizing that the position of volunteer coordinator most essentially has to emphasize people management skills. She said that, you know, learning how to work with the animals, how to handle the animals, is something that can be trained on site, but that person really has to understand how to manage people, relate to people, and especially volunteers. So that's an essential quality, she said. They do a lot with training levels, so you take volunteers and they go through one stage and then another stage that helps with volunteer retention. I know that Laura Bourbon does that also in the Brantford shelter. And then finally, she's just said about matching volunteers with the skills of the volunteers with the needs of the shelter. There are several needs. There are several ways to help the shelter. Sometimes it's directly working with the animals. Sometimes it's working on other sides of it. So this person knows how to, again, use management insight to match volunteers with the jobs that they're going to enjoy the most. So that's what I got out of that discussion.
Very good. Any other comments? The thought I had on this was based on some personal experience with my colleague, the mayor of Hamden, Connecticut. We share our animal control facility and a shelter in North Haven. And the volunteer concept was not working because of a broad range of areas that the volunteers were getting into. And they ended up being in conflict with the ACO and the local police departments. My thought on this was that maybe this task force, based on some of the things that we're talking about here, we tightly compartmentalize. We take the responsibility to tightly compartmentalize what we think the roles should be for the volunteers, develop the plan, and then the utilization of the volunteers is based on their agreement that these are the roles and responsibilities. Without that framework, I think it's fraught for problems in the future. Comments?
I agree wholeheartedly with that approach. I think it's the only way to bridge the two sides together.
Just a quick follow-up that in my experience, the problem isn't with volunteerism that's actually essential. It's the mismanagement of the volunteer programs. But we have, again, as models before us, very successful volunteer programs. So what I would be willing to do, for instance, is, submit to the committee's consideration here at Multnomah Shelter, they have a whole handbook in it, exactly what are the volunteers supposed to do, what are the qualities, what are the limitations, so we can use, as a starting point, I could submit this to the task force as a way to begin to look at various programs and how they're achieving just that.
Any other comments? Raymond?
Well, this is something I brought up at the last meeting, the importance of having a volunteer coordinator if the municipality so chooses to have volunteers in their shelters. I don't think it should be mandated that they have those, that they have volunteers, but if they so choose. And volunteers, like I said the last time, are very, very helpful to animal control officers. It loosens up their time a little bit with some of the more mundane projects that have to be done. And it benefits the animals as far as, you know, walking and caring and grooming, things like that, and helping with adoptions. But point being, I think that if the municipality does elect to have volunteers, then it should be mandated that a volunteer coordinator be hired by the municipality to coordinate those efforts of the volunteers in the shelters so that we don't see the problems that we are seeing in some of the municipal shelters now.
Ray, I like that. I think it was you that brought it up at the last meeting about some of the senior citizens coming in and participating as a volunteer group in an effort to reduce kennel stress, but then the reciprocal aspect of that is that it's almost a form of therapy and something for the seniors to do, and it really works both ways, and that was an interesting point that was made at the last meeting. So let's attempt to memorialize an action point for item number 9. Yes, Mark. Kimberly, I'm sorry.
I just want to reinforce your point about it increasing the quality of life for the animals in those shelters, because a lot of the animals do, when they spend a little bit too long in the shelter, as I'm sure our current animal control officer could attest to, those animals start to become attached to the only individual they're exposed to. And they really need to be exposed to more than one individual. So I think it's really important for their quality of life, and I do really agree with you in saying it is therapy in both ways for the animals and the people. And 100%, it needs to have guidelines and operate under rules and a supervisor, or you're going to have continued issues.
So in an attempt to develop an action point here, I'd like to suggest for our consideration that we develop a set of job responsibilities or what we think the volunteers should do. We'll take Mark's data, he'll pass it out to us, we'll use that as the framework or foundation, and then review that. And then in an effort for us to make a recommendation that for those municipalities, coming back to Raymond's point, that would like to utilize the volunteer network, these are our recommendations as to what the roles and responsibilities should be. Any comments? Okay. So Peter and Sarah, that's the action point. Okay. Item number 10. Review any research done by OLR regarding what other states are doing regarding 501(c) organizations who are rescues that work with municipal shelters. We have no research done by OLR. If there's no other comment on this, I would propose that we make this an action point for the next meeting, but I'm open for suggestions. All right. So then what we'll do is, for the sake of the record and the minutes, on item number 10, we're going to look to see if OLR is able to provide for us any research that other states are doing regarding 501(c) organizations who are rescues that work with municipal shelters. Any other comments on item number 10? Now, ladies and gentlemen, that is a list of the 10 action points. And, Mark, I want to come back to you. You had some additions, I believe.
Actually, I covered the additions as we went through it.
Excellent.
So we're all set. Yeah.
Very good. So if we move back to the agenda now and we look at item number 2, old business, in effect that what we've done by going through these 10 action points is we've gone through A, B, C, D, E, and F. Does everyone agree that we've done that? And if not, did we miss anything? Okay.
Mike, just
yes,
as a procedural matter, Do we need to make any sort of motion to carry forward our action plans, or is that just inherent in the motions already passed?
My feeling is because there are motions already passed, it's already inherent, so there's no need for motions. I see Peter and Sarah nodding also.
Fantastic.
I think we can move forward that way.
That's good news. Thank you.
We've covered, I think, the procedural aspect of what we're trying to accomplish.
Thanks.
So item 2G, other old business. Would anybody like to report or ask any questions about old business? Okay. Hearing none, I'd like to move on to item number 4, and I've categorized this as informational update. I'm going to ask Raymond to comment on this. We have a very nice collaborative program happening in January that really is not the purview of this particular task force, but it's an informational item for the task force and for the public. I am a member of the Police Officer Standard Training Council, and one of the initiatives that POST is collaborating with one of the organizations that's here today is a wonderful training session for ACOs regarding dogfighting and the viciousness that we've seen throughout the United States on this issue. So Susan Rainville, who works with us at POST, is handling this, but Ray Connors, our own task force member, is really the point person for it. So Ray, can you give us an update on this?
Oh, yeah. This was it's a blood sports training program for police officers and animal control officers and prosecutors, judges, anybody in law enforcement. I was approached by the ASPCA about this program, and they would like to bring it to Connecticut. And I says, oh, I have the perfect place for you. And we were able to do it through POST, through the Police Academy, scheduled for January 13th, I think, was the date. I'm working with Susan. They actually, working with POST and Susan Rainville, makes it so much easier because they take care of all the registrations for us, and it's basically a no-brainer. There's no cost involved or anything. So, we have over 200 seats in that auditorium, so hopefully every single one of them will be filled. I know that there has been a lot of interest in it, and we did have it here about 10 years ago, and we're actually trying to work a lot with POST and getting these programs into POST and made available to police officers. This particular blood sports training is part of the continuing education, not only for animal control officers at 5.5 hours they'll get for this, but also police officers. It's part of their in-service training. They'll also get credits for the criminal investigation part of it. So it's important, and it's big. I mean, we don't see that much organized dogfighting in the state of Connecticut. We see more organized cockfighting, and I think that this, you know, and it could be, like, I teach at the academy myself, and like I tell the cadets, it's any town, any time. We've had cockfighting rings in the town of Harrington. Last year was in Wolcott, which is a small town on the outside of Waterbury. And as a matter of fact, I was talking to a captain from Wolcott Police this morning, and they're sending people from their department. So I think it's good training to be out there and to train some of these police officers on what to look for when they get involved in these type of investigations into cockfighting and dogfighting. So looking forward to it, actually.
And I wanted to mention to this task force that I spoke with Susan. I'll be with her at our next POST meeting next week. And for any task force member that would like to attend, please let me know, and I will make arrangements to have you have a seat at that training as an observer.
Just a comment to say how fantastic this is. This is incredibly important, and I'm grateful for the offer for the task force to attend. There is, many of you may know, that in social media right now there's sort of a resurgence of interest and discussion in dogfighting once again. Not that it disappeared entirely, but it's one of those things that can disappear off our radar screens. But things like, for any of you who follow Hector the Pitbull, who is one of Vic's original dogs, he just died basically last week from a long battle with cancer, and that kind of thing's been all over social media. And also in Tennessee, just a few days ago, 50 dogs were found and seized by the Humane Society of the United States that are clearly part of a dog fighting ring. So there's a lot of discussion again in social media. So the timing of this is also incredibly important. But again, I'm very grateful this is taking place. It's fantastic.
Any other comments?
Yes. I'd like to attend.
Absolutely. Okay. So for those that would like to attend, just if you would, you have my email. Email me, and then I'll make arrangements for you to attend. Okay. Very good. Ray, thank you very much for sending out that update. That was very good for the task force to see, and it really shows the collaborative relationship between POST and the other organizations. And that's, I think, what we need to focus in on the future, too, a collaborative approach. Because in the end, everyone has the same objective. But unfortunately, what happens is ideologies get in the way of achieving the end result. And this is a good example, I think, this collaboration on how we can continue to move forward. Any other comments? Any other information anyone would like to provide for the rest of us? All right. We're at the point on the agenda of item number 5, open forum, commission member feedback, and suggestions for the next meeting. Many of them we've memorialized. I'm sorry, I've skipped by item number 3, new business. So let's move back to that. Anything under new business? Okay. Item number 4 we've covered, and item number 5, open forum. Suggestions, comments, ideas for the next meeting.
In what I like to call my notes, review the statute and current training, number 3. Can we put that on the agenda for December?
Yes. Agenda item for number 3, review, or for our December agenda will be number 3, review the statutes. And we'll work that out. I'll work that out with planning and development, Peter and Sarah. Mark?
Not to add to anybody's plate, but having the, and it resulted from an unfortunate circumstance, but having distilled the 10 talking points was incredibly helpful for today. If there's a way to extract those from the minutes, and fairly quickly, then we can really work very productively until the next meeting.
I will take that responsibility.
Thank you, Mike. Okay. That's very generous of you. Thank you.
Raymond?
What I talked about earlier, public testimony for the next meeting. I think that's going to take up the majority of the time at our next meeting, but I think it's very important that we do have that.
Okay. So. We have 2 suggestions for our agenda, one from Paul and one from Raymond. And what Raymond is saying, I mentioned earlier, is public testimony. And we will include that on the agenda for the next meeting starting in December. Very good.
Is the idea that the public testimony is just open testimony, or will there be topics that we'll be asking them to comment on?
It's open testimony. I mean, they know, people that come to testify, they know what the goals of the task force are, and we're just looking for public comment rather than just the comments from the task force itself to hear, what other people are thinking, within the state of Connecticut.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic.
So we will work towards that. All right, we're at the point, ladies and gentlemen, for the public, item number 6, public comment. Yes, Sergeant Keller. Step here, please. This is Sergeant Paula Keller from the New Britain Police Department. Right there, Sergeant.
My name is Sergeant Keller. I'm with New Britain Police Department, and I took over overseeing the animal control facility last year. I do have a couple of informational things I can pass along to you on some of the things that were commented on. In regards to point number 2 for improving adoption practices and awareness, one of the first things I did when I took over the shelter was to redo our adoption application. We had a very simplified one-page application when I first started. It's now a three-page application, and it's pretty intensive, and it does ask a lot of questions. One of the things that may be beneficial is if maybe we come up with a standard adoption application that all shelters will be required to use if they are, in fact, adopting out dogs specifically. That way we're all obtaining the same information. We're all going towards the same goal as far as where these animals are being placed. We're obtaining enough information to where we feel safe that these animals are, in fact, going into good homes. The background checks, when I first took over, I did check in with NCIC, and they will not allow us to use NCIC for informational purposes for adopting out the dogs. But you can go on the Connecticut Judicial website, and you can do a search by name and date of birth and look up any past convictions for animal abuse or any current cases that are ongoing for animal abuse that will show up. If they're from out of state, we really can't obtain that information. But that's just to pass along to you. The training standards for ACOs, I agree that we need to address that. One of the things that I have come across is that, you know, it's one thing to read a book, take an online course, or go to a lecture on animal control. But I don't think we have enough hands-on classes that actually teach people how to handle the animals. We encounter some very dangerous dogs out there, and it's imperative that we get the proper training, specifically with the snare poles. You know, those can be kind of dangerous if they're not used properly on the animals. One of the things that I was just thinking of is, in addition to the training that is done maybe outside of the classroom, is there a way that we can have animal control officers, new animal control officers, maybe do some form of an internship with an animal control officer? And are there ways that the current animal control officers can be tiered, such as, for example, within a police department, you have captains, lieutenants, and sergeants? Are there ways that we could maybe, in fact, tier our animal control officers so that if somebody is a sergeant animal control officer, it means they have X amount of years of experience with handling, with laws, and then that person is qualified to do the internship with a new animal control officer so that that person we know is properly trained. Instead of saying we're only requiring you to do 80 hours of work, 80 hours of class time, and then you can go off and be an animal control officer, to me that's not, to me it's not enough. I'm in complete agreement with that. Also in regards to training, I don't think that we should overlook our police officers. I went to the Post Academy. I had probably a two-hour block of training on animal control, and it was never spoken about again in the police department. And our police officers, when the animal control officer is not available, are the ones that are out there that are taking these calls, and 9 times out of 10, they refer everything to the animal control officer. And that overwhelms our animal control officers, specifically in these urban cities where we have a high population of people, and you maybe have two animal control officers that are supposed to address all of these issues. And they're not just addressing the animals on the streets. They're in charge of the adoption. Some of them are in charge of keeping up the shelters. They're in charge of the dog bites. They're in charge of enforcement. They're in charge of licensing. That's a heck of a lot of work to put on 2 or 4 people when a population of dogs in a big city could be up to 10,000. So I think we need to look at retraining our police officers in animal law. One of the things that I actually did start doing in New Britain is in-house training on how to handle some of these dog calls and reassuring the officers that they can do it. And I think one of the things that makes this disconnect so big between the police officers and enforcing the animal control laws is they simply don't understand the laws because they haven't been trained. It's similar to some of the police officers don't like to do a DUI stop because it's a very complicated thing to do. They don't know all the procedures, so they avoid it. If you don't know how to do something, you're going to avoid it. If we make them comfortable and teach them how to enforce some of these laws, I think enforcement goes along the ways with education, with the overbreeding, with the overpopulation, with these people dumping the dogs out. We have licensing. It's a state law. The dogs have to be licensed. If we can get the dogs licensed, we can keep track of them. So that, to me, the police officers are out on the streets every day. They encounter more people than the animal control officers do. They probably see more dogs in houses than the animal control officers do. There's no reason why they can't address those issues when they're out on the streets. I think we'll have a fight on our hands in the beginning, but if we start from the academy and maybe POST can somehow mandate that maybe every 2 years the police officers get a couple of hours of training in animal law, specifically now since, Ray, you talked about that cross-reporting for animal abuse and child abuse. It shouldn't just be DCF. DCF is secondary. DCF usually gets the reports from the police officers. If the police officers are the first ones on the scene and there's animals in the house that they suspect are being abused and that's not reported firsthand, by the time the DCF worker actually gets out to that home, the animal may no longer be there. So it's important that the officers get trained on this as well, about the cross-reporting, about looking for these signs for animal abuse, because they are the first ones on the scene. DCF is, 9 times out of 10, DCF is never the first one on scene. It's usually the police officers. So again, it comes down to the training. I talked about the animal abuse, not being able to look that up. And like I said, the dogs being dumped out, it's a huge problem everywhere. And it's not, you know, specific to New Britain. It's not specific to Connecticut. It's a national problem. One of the things that I did in New Britain was I passed a breeder's ordinance. If you want to breed your dog in the city of New Britain, you have to have a breeder's permit. In addition to that breeder's permit, you have to have a litter permit for every litter that that dog produces, so that we can ensure that you're not overbreeding your dog if we do allow you to breed your dog. So that's one of the ways we're trying to control the population of dogs. We even did a door-to-door canvas to see how many dogs were licensed in specific areas where we were having a lot of problems. And we handed out 50 city ordinance violations just by going out in 3 different times. I did a team of 4 officers and myself. We went door to door. Like I said, we went out 3 times. And within that time frame that we went out, 111 people went and got their dogs licensed. So the enforcement does work.
Do you mind if I ask you a question?
No, go right ahead.
How do you handle the situation when you don't have a licensed dog that's clearly not used for breeding but is pregnant and they're having puppies and you see this happening? How do you handle that situation?
Well, right now, what I can do, the Common Council, when I passed the ordinance, they asked that for the first year we have lax enforcement on this breeder's permit because people were not aware that it existed. So what we decided to do is go out and give verbal warnings, and I printed out pamphlets with the information for the city ordinance violation that we did. So, and then we keep track of that by saying, okay, we've been out to this house. We have a logbook of it. We know where the puppies are. If I come back here and you have additional puppies, you know, you'll be subject to the fine. You'll be subject to having your dog seized because it's right in the ordinance that we can take your dog.
So in the paper, is there a referral to a low-cost spay-neuter clinic?
Well, we do, yes, we absolutely do, refer them to low-cost spay and neuter. And a lot of it does come down to education. There are some people that just don't realize that they have to take their dogs to get a rabies vaccine by law and that they have to get their dog's license. A lot of people just honestly just don't know that, and then the other half know it and ignore it, and they use their dogs as a source of income. And those are the people that we're targeting, the constant breeders, you know, and they were putting signs in the window, puppies $250. I mean, before this ordinance, I was very sneaky about how I was able to get those dogs out of the house, but I would. Don't ask me how. I did.
Do you mind another quick question?
Sure.
And this actually is a question for Ray as well. A couple years ago, under the DiStefano administration in New Haven, there was discussion about also having a breeder's ordinance and then hopefully taking that to the state level. So congratulations to New Britain. You've actually moved ahead on that, and I think that's incredibly important. Ray, would you have any feedback or comment on whether this could become a statewide initiative or law?
Actually, I'm going to reserve my answer because I am meeting with Sergeant Keller next week to discuss exactly what her ordinance is and how well it's working.
We'll discuss it next time, then. Thanks.
One of the other things that I do in regards to keeping track of euthanasia, the euthanasia rate in New Britain has severely dropped. Ray, I think you can attest to that since I've come aboard. We do not euthanize for space. We have a dog that's been there since July. His name's Munson. He kind of likes it there. He gets lots of attention. One of the other things that I did when I took over the facility is I had two outdoor dog pens built. And they're actually very big, and the dogs can go out, they can play ball, we do meet and greets out there, so the dogs do get their outdoor time. Euthanasia is a very touchy subject. And in regards to documentation, one of the things that I was discussing with my ACO just today, as a matter of fact, was having keeping files on dogs that are euthanized. We do have what I call temperament cards or intake cards. And the patrol officers, even if they take a dog in, they're supposed to fill these cards out because we need to know from the time that that dog was encountered on the street, I want to know what the disposition of it was when the officer had it. Was it barking, growling, scared, snarling? Was it sick? Did it have to be pole snare? Were you able to handle it? There's all questions. There's all little check boxes that they check off so that when we come in the morning, we know this is how the dog reacted on the street, because that's a totally different reaction than what we're going to get when the dog's in the kennel, and we know that. And we usually give the dogs 3 or 4 days to decompress if they're scared or if they're showing any kinds of aggression. And then we do our temperament testing, and we test them with other dogs. You know, the unfortunate part, if a dog has a bite history specifically or is known dog aggressive, meaning it has attacked another dog, the municipality is not going to take the liability of adopting that dog out regardless of whether it's being rehabilitated or not. And the sad fact is nobody's knocking on our door asking us to give them our problem dog. So maybe some of the funding that we're looking into getting could be for maybe a state center specific to dogs that we possibly think could be rehabilitated, meaning maybe they don't have the bite history, they just have that temperament, that aggressiveness. Maybe they haven't attacked another dog, but we can see the dog aggression in them. Maybe these are the dogs that could be saved if there is a place to put them, but we can't expect the municipalities to be able to rehabilitate these dogs. It's a very long process. We're just simply not trained to do that, and we don't have the resources, the space, or the money to do it, but that may be something that in the future, if we're looking for funding for something, towards saving, you know, these types of dogs that we're deeming unadoptable, but that maybe could be saved. Maybe that is something we can look for the funding, a place to bring these dogs.
Could I just make a quick comment on that? That's an incredibly insightful and I think very compelling suggestion, and for two reasons. Connecticut's a small enough state where that sort of thing is quite feasible. It might not work for much larger states, but right. we could do that here. And my interactions and experience with these national funding groups is that absolutely there would be funding available. One of the opportunities we have here on the task force, in one way we're trying to sort of catch up with the national humane standards be there with the best shelters around the country, but I think we also have an opportunity to get ahead of the game and be models. And being able to do something like that at the state level is really a very compelling idea, and I think I'm sure there are notable behaviorists and experts who would certainly, you know, work at that level, and it does take the burden off the municipality. So I want to thank you for that suggestion. That's really thought-provoking.
Well, thank you. And the other thing that I wanted to touch on is a very touchy subject for us in New Britain, is the volunteer program. We've had some interesting interactions with volunteers in the past, and it's just gotten to the point now where we just don't have any in our facility at this point. And like you said, it does come to a point where you have volunteers, while they're very well-meaning, they don't understand the concept of liability as far as the municipality is concerned. And we do often end up, you know, going head-to-head on different issues. And unfortunately, it just hasn't worked out for us. But In New Britain, we have a community service officer program, and you know, this is for the police department. They're community service officers, which means they're members of our community that come in. They have a background check. They go through an academy, and they learn how to do various tasks that they're allowed to do. They're not by any means law enforcement officers, but they go out and they proactively patrol. They have a car, community service officer car. They have police radios. So their dedication is to the municipality. And what I'm starting to do now is cross-train our community service officers to work at our shelter so that they can help with adoption procedures. They can start calling on our delinquent license book. And if they're comfortable enough, they can come down and take the dogs out. We're going to start giving them full access to the shelter. So, because a lot of them work regular jobs. They're 9-to-5 people, and they'll come in at night, and they'll ride around in the cars and you know, assist with the police officers. But what I would like to see them doing is, if they're there at night, go down to the shelter, take a dog for a walk, give them cookies, make sure they have water, interact with them. Because I think, like you said, it's helpful. We've seen the dogs when they're kenneled too much. You know, sometimes it gets to the point where they almost look like they're unadoptable, or they do become too attached to that one person. You know, and then if somebody comes in to adopt the dog, and all they want to do is hang out with the animal control officer, it's kind of like, you know, Jimmy, go take a ride somewhere so you're not in the building. So. These are just some of the things, ideas that I have, and some of the things that we were doing in New Britain to try to be very proactive. I, like most police officers, I did not realize how bad the problem was until they put me in charge of it. And we do have a very serious problem with the dogs being dumped off. One of the other things that I was going to work on with our corporation council is a zoning ordinance. We find that we have a problem with multifamily buildings. We're getting most of our dog bites are coming from these multifamily buildings because we're overpopulating these buildings with dogs. And these people don't own just one, they own 2, 3, 4 dogs in a small apartment. And the reason why these dogs are becoming aggressive is because they're crated. They're not walked. Some of them are just allowed to, you know, go to the bathroom in the house. They don't get taken outside. And that creates fear of anything outside of that apartment. So as soon as they get out, everything is strange to them, and that's when they become aggressive. That's when these dog bites happen, or the dogs encounter each other in the hallway. They fight. So we really wanted to try to get a grip on, you know, something acceptable for allowing people to own dogs in apartment buildings, but not to abuse that, you know, and to try to address the overpopulation. Again, in the multifamily dwelling. And the other problem that we have in the, you know, urban cities like New Britain, we have a very transient community. These people, a lot of them move from apartment to apartment. They can't always take their dog with them. And we get inundated with calls. My landlord says I can't keep my dog anymore. Or I'm moving and I can't take my dog with me. And honestly, we just don't have the room. We don't. We try to give them the resources you know, to get their animals adopted, you know, but then you ask them, is your animal spayed or neutered? No. Does your animal current on vaccines? No. Well, now you're way behind the eight ball because nobody's going to want that. Is your dog friendly? No. You know, so, you know, how do we address this problem? You know, and it all comes back to education and enforcement. And one of the key things, I think, is making that contact with them and getting them to get their dogs licensed, because that is the way that we track the dog. And if people start getting the idea that owning a dog is going to cause the police a police contact with them, they may choose not to have a dog. And that's our ultimate goal. If they're not responsible dog owners, they may just choose not to have a dog. And I think the other thing is educating people on what it entails to own a dog. It's a responsibility. It's a 10-15-year commitment. It's money. It's responsibility, it's time, it's effort. These are things that people just don't realize when they take that dog into their home. You know, and then when the dog exposes some kind of behavioral issue, a lot of times their answer is to just throw the dog out into the street. So, I thank you for your time.
We have a question for you.
Okay.
Actually, it's not a question, it's a comment. Sergeant Keller has been at the New Britain Pound just a little over a year, and she has made magnificent strides. She is the most dedicated woman I have met in this field in a very long time, and I just want to comment that I'm lucky to be able to work with you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So for the public, Kimberly, just I want to make a comment. Some may not be aware of this, but based on recommendations of Paula here, Raymond Connors, I have positioned Sergeant Keller to be a member of this task force. Chief Wardwell has sent me a formal recommendation. We've submitted it to the state, and I'm hoping to have Sergeant Keller on this task force at least by January at the latest.
Thank you.
Kimberly.
I think that that's a fabulous recommendation. And I do like a lot of what you covered and the points you brought up. And sadly, I'm going to work from the end of your comments forward. Those dogs that they're calling you because they're moving and they can't keep their dog, when you say no, I see them for euthanasia.
I'm sure
for euthanasia. And then you're standing there face to face saying no. And sometimes I have to say yes because I can't personally take that dog home. And I have a hard time sleeping at night knowing that when I say no and that family walks out that door, that dog gets thrown out that car as they drive out of the animal hospital driveway.
And it ends up with the animal control facility anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I talked to Sherry from Hartford just yesterday because I, you know, wanted to touch base with her about what was going on in Hartford. And we were both comparing notes, and we're very, very much past the numbers of dogs that we took in this year as opposed to last year. We're, you know, way ahead. For some reason, we have had a severe influx of dogs over the past 2 months. And it's not even, you know, if we only had half our kennels filled, there are times where we will take relinquishment if the dog is adoptable and placeable. You know, we absolutely will. But when we have 16 dogs and I only have 18 kennels, you know, I can't because we just don't have the room.
No, absolutely. I totally agree.
Yeah.
But I understand and I think that your thought process is exactly right. Target those people who are irresponsible because at some point in time, they won't want to see the police at their door because they have a dog.
And that's what I'm hoping because
yeah.
We do go door to door. We knock on their doors and... Yeah, but the second time we went out, not as many people were answering their doors because they knew what we were doing. So that the numbers dropped off the second time we went out. I'm like, oh, boy, word's out on the street. But it did work.
Something else you made me recall, you made me recall, was that I do some shelter work. And I've seen a rise in expectation from people who are potentially adopting dogs and shelters that are so overburdened and overwhelmed that as soon as that animal is found to have something that's very fixable, treatable, or can be present and live like that without a problem, such as luxating patella, so a kneecap that moves, can be comfortable, doesn't have to be a problem. But as soon as that potential adopter finds out that that knee is less than perfect, they're looking back to the municipality to start to pay and correct those things. And we need to do something to protect the municipality and the potential adopters' expectations that there is no guarantee in health here, and you get what you adopt, and that's a very acceptable problem to live with.
Well, in addition to redoing the adoption application, I worked with our corporation counsel and coming up with an adoption waiver. And when they adopt the dog, they sign a liability waiver that says they are accepting 100% responsibility for that dog and that we are not going to be financially responsible for any cost that they incur once they take that dog out of the facility.
I think that's very important because, sadly, some of these shelters, like I say, are totally overburdened or just can't handle one more complaint item need from them. They can't do it. They're so overtaxed.
It's very overtaxing.
Yeah.
But, you know, ultimately, I have a team, and we're all police officers. We don't have any civilians at our facility. We're all police officers.
Wow.
And I have handpicked my team, and we all love the dogs, and we are all actively out there enforcing laws. We're doing warrants. You know, we are actively going after people.
And personally, I like seeing the police officers at the shelters, and it brings me back to the last point and something you brought up fairly early on. is talking about your education and animal behavior exposure and handling exposure and how it's quite minimal, and it really needs to not be as minimal as it is, because there's such easy recognition of what that animal is doing right now. But if you are already fearful of animals, never owned a dog, and you're, as a beat police officer out there, you're going to encounter a lot of animals that are just wandering around, and you're probably not going to handle it properly.
No, that's correct, and I do see that a lot. And I encourage our police officers to come down to the shelter, visit the dogs. And oftentimes when they pick up a dog and they're dropping it off, I ask them to come in, see our dogs, and, you know, it's everybody loves dogs. I mean, you know, I think 90% of our officers own dogs. So, you know, I try to play on that. If they like the dogs and they start taking it a little bit more personally, it's easier to encourage them to enforce.
Absolutely. So those intake forms that the police officers are filling out for you, you probably take into account the individual who's filling it out?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Unless it says friendly across the board, then I'm like, okay, the dog is... If it says friendly across the board, I know the dog has no issues with people when the patrol officers are bringing him in.
Thank you for your time. It's been lovely to meet you.
Okay. Thank you.
We have a couple of more points here, Sergeant Keller, as we wind down for this task force meeting. Mark, and then I'm going to turn it over to Paul. Mark?
Yeah, just two quick things. And again, thank you, Officer Keller, for this point by point, Sergeant Keller, excuse me, for this point by point description. Two things that actually you pointed out something that is supposed to be on the task force agenda, and that was we were considering a standardized adoption form statewide. So if we could get that back on the agenda, actually, thank you for reminding us of that.
You're welcome.
And you were so thorough that there's one thing that I didn't hear you comment on that, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you about, and that is your relationship that you're building in New Britain with rescue organizations and how they can potentially help out with these issues.
We do have a couple different rescue organizations that we work with. However, there's no state regulations on any of these rescue groups, and my feeling is, a lot of these rescue groups, and I understand they want to help, but a lot of them come in and they only want to take the small adoptable dogs. You know, if the rescue groups were truly helping us, that the dog that we've had since July would have been in a foster home already. So, I often wonder when they are taking these dogs out, the rescue groups take them and place them out in fosters, who's regulating those fosters? What I just got permission to do, we're doing our own Facebook page now, what I just got permission to do is the New Britain Police Department, in conjunction with our animal control officer, we are going to do our own fosters. We're going to advertise for fosters. They're going to have a home visit, a background check, and we're going to be very, very thorough and very picky. They're going to have to be available for our adoption hours. So that way we're dealing directly with the fosters. So we know where these dogs are going, and we feel a little bit safer, because right now there's no regulation. Anybody can print up a card and say they're with ABC Rescue and come in. And, you know, honestly, we just don't know where these dogs are going. And a lot of these rescue groups, they have big hearts. The fosters have big hearts. But sometimes your rescue groups and your fosters are your biggest hoarders. It's unfortunate, but, you know, sometimes you go to their houses and they're overloaded with dogs because they're striving so hard to save that one dog that's slated for euthanasia that they're not thinking clearly about the atmosphere they're putting that dog in by taking it to an overcrowded home.
Right. And at the same time, there are truly reputable rescue organizations in the state who are incredibly responsible and accountable, and that's something I think the task force we can continue to look into. And we had discussed that at the last meeting, standards of evaluating and, in a sense, endorsing rescue organizations, so one can make the distinction between, quite frankly, the hoarders
right.
and the ones who are really essential
like to
help. Yeah, and there are quite
a
few
like
around
to see rescue
Connecticut
endorsed by the state, so
yeah.
that we know when they come
who
in,
can know exactly
who they are, and that they do have credentials, and that they are trustworthy, and that these dogs are going to be going to good fosters.
Exactly. Thank you.
Paula.
One other thing that Sergeant Keller has done with the city ordinances is require that the dogs have a parvo vaccination. And that's something I would love the state level to demand like they demand rabies.
Raymond?
First, let me address the parvo issue. It is an issue statewide. Currently, we only require rabies vaccines for licensing, that being because it's a public health risk, whereas canine parvovirus is not. It's not even a reportable disease. Veterinarians do not need to report it to the state. So I just wanted to make that point, but kudos to Sergeant Keller for instituting that ordinance within the city of New Britain, because I know they've had a lot of canine parvovirus issues in their facility. Sergeant, I just wanted to clarify a couple of things. You were talking about ACO training. A lot of municipalities have one animal control officer, and unfortunately there's not a person to train them. And that's where my department steps in and acts as their FTO, basically doing ride-alongs with the state officer to get them trained up on how to, for a lot of the practical aspects of their job, not just the classroom stuff that they would have learned through the NACA Academy. Post-training. Up to 2 years ago, it was 1 hour, and I probably taught your class, actually, because I've been doing it that long. It was a one-hour class, and I was like a speed demon trying to cover so many topics in less than an hour's time. Just within the last 2 years, we now have 2 hours.
Wow.
So that's, and you know how the academy runs, and to get an extra hour out of anything at post is a godsend. And I fill every single second of that 2 hours right up to the last minute when the cadets are ready to go to lunch or home for the weekend.
They must love you.
Yeah, they do. Actually, they do. They enjoy my class very much. It's a good time. Sergeants such as yourself at municipal shelters, actually in the last 5 years, we've seen a huge increase in that. My department has done a lot of internal investigations, assisting municipalities with some issues that they've had in their municipal facilities with the animal control officers. And the outcome of a lot of those, and I think the word spread quickly, has led to dismissals of animal control officers. Since then, we've seen a huge increase in supervisors such as yourself overseeing animal control officers, and most recently the city of Bridgeport now has a police lieutenant who actually is at the shelter all the time overseeing, and for a municipality of that size to take a lieutenant and put them in that capacity is a godsend. City of Waterbury also has Sergeant Harvey overseeing their animal control officers. So it's a big plus to see police officers overseeing animal control officers, and because animal control officers, they are law enforcement officers, and they need to have somebody in a supervisory capacity overseeing exactly what's going on there, not just giving them free rein to do what they want with their facility. The other thing is, I have a question. You said your impoundments are up, especially the last few months. Do you think that would have anything to do with the new ordinance? I'm just curious that, because people are saying that, hey, we got this new ordinance, so you know what, just dump the dog because we're not going to take the fine.
I don't know if it has to do with the new ordinance or it has to do with the fact that they know we're out there doing enforcement. I think people that own dogs that are going to be responsible dog owners would gladly just get the parvovirus vaccine. But we have never done this before. We've actively gone door to door doing enforcement. So, and I did have a talk with my captain prior to doing this, and I did explain to him that I said I expect in the first year that we do this, and when we start actively doing enforcement, that we are going to see an influx of dogs, and I was right. That may very well be. But then I called Hartford, and they're having the same problem. And when I looked last year at the MAKO reports from last year, our numbers went up in October last year, too. Last year we were very, very crowded in October as well, so I don't know what it is about October, but October is a bad month for us. February is much better. Looking forward to it. February, the numbers go down. We don't have any parvo. So the other thing that, you know, may come into play, as I was talking about the transient community that we have when they're apartment dwellers and they move quite often, a lot of times people move over the summer times, make sure their kids are into the school system by September. And it may be that by October, the new landlord has caught on that they have a dog, and that may be when they've reached the end of
being able to keep that dog before the eviction process starts. And because this is when we're getting a high volume of calls about, I can't keep my dog, I can't keep my dog, my landlord's going to evict me. So I think, you know, people moving over the summertime, getting settled into their new apartments in September, and then, you know, by October, you know, it's you know, you're either going to get rid of the dog or I'm going to start the eviction process. That, I think that may play a lot into it as well.
I just want to make a comment with respect to you saying your numbers are up. And just to let you know, in the veterinary field, right around this time, we stop seeing appointments. It really starts to decline, and we don't really start to see these animals again until after the new year.
Something about this time of month, this time of year, I guess, yeah.
Sergeant Keller, thank you very much for spending some time with us.
Oh,
and
thank
we
you
are
for letting me be long-winded.
Truly looking forward to working with you as a member
thank
of this
you.
Task
I am
force.
So. I'm very excited to be part of the committee.
So, ladies and gentlemen, any other public comment?
Animal Sanctuary, and I'm also a member of Connecticut Votes for Animals. I know that we're running late on time, so I'll be really brief. I was just really appreciate the opportunity to make some suggestions for the next meeting. I wasn't at the last meeting, so if this idea has come up and it's something the committee is looking into, I would appreciate it. If not, I hope you'd consider it. One of the issues I think that is something that we've been trying to work towards legislatively over the years and haven't been successful, and I think it's a very obvious issue, is that the animals that are going into our municipal pounds are leaving intact. There is not a spay neuter before release. And there is an APCP voucher program which allows adopters to then get them neutered and spayed. But sadly, I think the redemption rate for that is a pathetic 60-70%. I could be wrong, but it's not good. And we have these animals right now in our shelters. And the fact that we're letting them go out while we had them there without being spayed and neutered, I think, is something that really needs to be addressed. And it seems just very sensible to me. I appreciate the interest in collecting data about the disposition of euthanasia, why animals are being euthanized. And I'd ask the committee to consider maybe having some statistics on cats. Right now, there's only dogs, and there's nothing that even describes what cats are in there. So if there could be some equal treatment towards the data for cats, I think that'd be a really good idea. In fact, right now, there's really no way to distinguish if shelters taking cats or not. The other thing that I found a lot with municipal shelters is that a lot of them were built a long time ago, and they're falling apart. I wonder if there might be a good idea to have a recommendation for towns to have a capital improvements plan. This rebuilding some of these shelters, and it requires rebuilding, and the location some of these shelters are in, transfer stations and near the town dump, you know, maybe a plan for rebuilding an area where people actually know they have a shelter. And these are often, you know, $200,000-$300,000 capital projects. And so having towns have a plan for addressing that, what you find is some of these shelters are literally crumbling and falling apart. And it's just something the town keeps putting off and putting off because it's a big nut to swallow, you know. And also the whole idea of regionalization, which seems to, you know, kind of evolve out of having to finally build that new shelter. Finally, as far as, and I don't know if this is out of the purview of this committee, if it's specifically talking about municipal shelters, but the discussion about rescue groups. Ray and I have been talking about an interest that I would love to see to professionalize organizations, animal rescue organizations. You know, I would love the opportunity to be on a list of organizations in Connecticut that says, yes, they're licensed, yes, it's a viable and, you know, appropriately running nonprofit. So if there's any opportunity for that to be a recommendation for private shelters, it would caution the task force about residences. We had a long fight a few years ago about the government coming in and inspecting people's private homes. But I'm talking about brick-and-mortar shelters or rescue facilities. I think that it's, you know, I think any reputable rescue and shelter would welcome the opportunity to be licensed and inspected and you know, be able to be distinguished that way from other groups that may not be as reputable. And finally, a recommendation about improving dog licensing, which everyone, of course, wants to do. A few years ago, we tried to have a legislative, create a bill and pass it to require when animals are get the rabies vaccine that the veterinarian forwards a copy to the town clerk. That way, the animal control officer can go to the town clerk and say, you know, who are these vaccinated animals for rabies, compare with the dog licensing list, and then see who's not licensed. Right now, you literally have to go knocking door to door, and I think that's a little ridiculous. So if there's perhaps any appetite to look into that issue again, it's a source of revenue, and it's a way to increase licensing. So that was just some issues that perhaps you've been considering, and if not, I hope that you maybe put some thought into. So thank you for the opportunity. Thanks. Thank you.
Just a couple quick follow-up comments on that. Yeah, no, I think those are all very important points, and thank you for bringing those up. I'd like to offer New Haven as an example for the spay-neuter thing that you mentioned. In New Haven, when a dog is adopted, when the adoption is finalized, the dog goes directly to the vet to be neutered or spayed, and then the adopter picks and it's all part of the redemption program, so it gets all covered. So there is a way to do that. There's a precedent, and that alleviates the very problem you were talking about. So we do have an example of that, at least one example in our state to consider. Coincidentally, the New Haven Humane Commission, with a little probably unintentional prodding from Ray, or maybe intentional prodding from Ray, has just begun official discussions about building a new animal shelter. So thanks for bringing that up. And in terms of dog licensing, the Multnomah Shelter in Portland, they do it online. And they found out that once they started doing online licensing, it went way up. So there's just sometimes facilitating something that way can help as well. So just those brief comments, and thank you again for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I just have one comment. Susan, you don't need to come back. But first of all, thank you for speaking. I just wanted, you talked about municipal shelters, and I just want to state an observation that within the last 5 years, we've seen a huge increase in new facilities being built statewide. Some are very costly. The town of Shelton actually is ready to move into their facility next week, long overdue for a new facility. The town of Greenwich built a new facility. The town of Stratford, City Stratford, has a state-of-the-art facility, which is absolutely gorgeous. So we're starting to see a lot of new shelters being built statewide. Newtown just put up a new pound. It's really nice. So, and they're not at the transfer stations or next to the sewer treatment plant. When I spoke at Stanford Hospital the other day, the gentleman that was I was speaking with, Phil Arco, who does the coalition between animal abuse and child abuse programs nationwide, he says, you know, every time I'm in a town and I want to go visit the animal shelter, I just follow my nose because they're always next to the sewer treatment plant. So, you know, we like to get that stigma away from that. So, but it's nice to know that the municipalities are starting to revitalize some of their buildings and taking an interest rather than just some old building that they put up next to the town dump to house some dogs in. So we're seeing a big difference now.
Any other public comment? Well, thank you very much. I thought this was a very productive meeting today. We have a lot to continue to do. We have a game plan for our next meeting in December. And on behalf of Dr. Kimberly McDonald, Mr. Mark Bailey, Mrs. Paula Poplosky, Diane Collette, and Mr. Raymond Connors, I'm Michael Frieda. Thank you for joining us, and to our viewing audience across the state, thank you for watching. I'd like to entertain a motion to adjourn. Do I have a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.